Jack Spierka with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we flash back to October the 7th, 2011, originally episode 758 of the Survival Podcast, Frank Sharp on the coming unrest and on home defense. And this was a really great episode. I think when you listen to it, some of the examples he gives about what could potentially happen invoke things that had happened in other parts of the world, like some things that happened in India. You might say, well, none of this stuff actually happened. But, you know, actually, we had a lot of civil unrest, didn't we? And it would have been really easy for it to go completely over the edge. I think that it got very close. One of the things that you hear him talk about during this are the Rodney King riots from L.A. in the 90s and how close that came to going national and going completely overboard. The BLM riots were very close. Very close to becoming a national catastrophe. And I know if you live and you own property where they happen, you're like, they were. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the total extreme example. And what that tells us is that we're always one angled properly news story from some of these things happening. And that's without foreign actors. And now we have other things going on in the world and people that don't really like us, some for not so good reasons and some for some pretty good reasons. And so I think this episode is as timely as it ever was. And we don't just talk about those big threats. We also talk about the individual threats in this episode and things you can do to make your home and your life and your family more secure. So with that, let us flash back to October 7th, 2011, originally episode 758. And just to drive home how long ago that really is, yesterday we did, for new episodes, episode 3,601. I will be with you next week for one day anyway of a new show, and then we'll have holiday shows and rewinds and flashbacks until after the first of the year. I will be gone between Christmas and New Year's. I wish you a great and happy holiday, but again, check in on Monday for at least one new episode next week. With that, I got the housekeeping wrapped up, and I want to introduce at this time Frank Sharp Jr. of Fortress Defense Consultants. As I said before, Frank is one of my favorite guests to have on the Survival Podcast. He always brings us a stark dose of reality. That's one of the things I love about him. He also has a great school, a great training program, and he's recently had some great folks from TSP there. Hey, Frank, welcome back to the Survival Podcast.
Jack, how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm glad to, again, I'm glad to have you here. For folks that maybe haven't heard your previous interviews, they probably know you because you are the lead instructor and owner of Fortress Defense Consultants. But, you know, you want to give people just like the 30-second background resume on who you are for new listeners?
Oh, absolutely. I was an apprentice for an instructor by the name of John Farnham. I actually still am. I work for his company, which is Defense Training International, helping him with classes around the country. And that's kind of where I learned how to do all this stuff. I'm an NRA instructor, International Association of Law Enforcement Firearms Instructors, a bunch of, you know, organizations like that where I take continuing education and that sort of thing. Pretty much, though, I've just been doing it for 10, 12 years now out on the range, and that's where I've gotten my experience. And at this point, I'd like to think I know what I'm doing, but that's always up to the students to decide.
Well, cool, man. You actually just had a class that some TSP listeners attended. You want to give us a little update?
Yeah, that was great. We actually gave away two spots on the last interview, and I believe the interview was posted, and it was an hour and 1 minute after it was posted because we gave them away right at the end of the show. I'd already had calls and got the two spots taken. But had a few other listeners end up signing up also. So we had I think there were four or five people in the class that were listeners of yours and just all wonderful people. Again, I can't say enough good things about your audience. They're, definitely quality. And, we had a level one pistol course, which is just our way of saying our basic pistol course, and, amazing, improvement by everybody there. It was just one of those courses, myself and my co-instructors, we were at dinner on Sunday night after the class was done, just agreeing it was one of the best ones we ever did. Just watching the, progression of the students from the beginning to the end, they just made amazing, leaps in their skills, and everybody left happy. It was just really a great class.
Yeah, I mean, the people that I heard back from that went there said that a couple of them had never actually been to a training before, and they really thought they kind of had this stuff cold, but they quickly, when faced with some training, realized what they didn't have down cold and said that they were actually amazed at how much progress they made in a single course.
And they all worked hard. A lot of it has to do with the attitude of a person coming into a class. Myself and my instructors from my school, we consider ourselves professional students. I try to take 2-3 classes a year at the basic level from other schools as much as I can. And, you know, you have to park your ego at the door and you have to say, I'm here to learn. And, you know, what I knew before that may be relevant in my life, but for this weekend it's not. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to listen to what this person has to say and I'm going to do it their way. And that, you know, when you open your mind up, you can progress and learn things. And a lot of us who take classes, you know, we learned 95% of what we were going to learn about guns in our first class, and we're chasing that last 5% with every class we take. So every time I go take something, I learn something new, and I usually bring it back to my own students, and so do my other instructors. I love it when my instructors go take classes and come back and say, hey, look what I learned, and we're like, oh, great, we should incorporate that, or that's not going to work because of this reason or whatever, but you know, you can't expand yourself and you can't get better without exposing yourself to new ideas. So having that proper attitude of going into it to learn, and that's what I saw 2 weekends ago. Just everybody was there to learn, and they were just soaking up the information, and they're putting huge effort into it, and that's when you get progress.
Absolutely, and I think maybe you're going to maybe do this again for some folks with a rifle course coming up. Maybe we'll save exactly what to do till the end.
Maybe we'll talk about that later.
All right, I'll try to
leave it to the end, then I don't get inundated with calls when you first post
this. All right, I'll bend Frank's arm a little bit toward the end here, folks, see if we can get you guys some more seats gratis, so to speak. But one of the things we were chatting about by email before today's show was checking your equipment and some interesting things that popped up recently that you noticed. Something about a gun with its sights?
Oh, yeah. That last weekend I had a private student that I was working with, and it was really amazing. I should back up here. A lot of times when we're out at the range and we're having students who are having problems making hits, they want to blame it on their equipment. And that's nothing to slight any students that I've had. That's just kind of human nature, is that, you know, your last thing that you think it could possibly be is your own self-control. It just has to be your equipment. And so we had one of these happening in a class. And, you know, the student was really focused and really trying their best to make hits. And so, as usual, as an instructor, usually what we'll do is we'll ask to borrow their gun and we'll make hits with it and show them that, you know, the sights are fine, the gun's fine, it's just, you know, your own trigger control is the problem here. Well, I shot the gun and my co-instructor shot the gun and we couldn't make hits with it either. And I kind of looked at him and he looked at me and we said, something's not right here. So upon further inspection, this gun had come from the factory with the front sight actually a little more than a 16th inch lower than the rear sight. And that was causing high hits. And so on targets close up, we were having no problem. But as we started moving back 20, 25 meters, you were shooting over the top of the target. And we're actually sending the gun back. It's a major manufacturer. It's a gun everybody's heard about. And we're not sure what caused this, if the wrong sight's gotten the wrong parts bin somewhere in the factory or what. But they're still addressing it. So when I get an answer, I'll let you know. But to the point of what you said originally, what started this, we need to get out on the range and try our equipment. So many people buy guns and they put them up on the top shelf of their closet, and it's this magic amulet that's going to ward off evil, and they haven't taken it out and run it through its paces yet. We need to know if it's going to run our defensive ammo. We need to know if it's going to work at all, if it's going to work when it gets hot, if the gun's going to, you know, function as advertised with the sights that are on it and all the parts. So we had one of these rare occasions where the sights were bad on a gun. And, you know, that's something that I don't see very often. That's actually the first time I've seen it out on the range. But, yeah, we could blame her missed shots to bad sights.
I bet she finally felt vindicated, too. She's like, man, I knew it wasn't me, because I've dealt with that with teaching people, too. Yeah, it's the gun. It's the gun, and you pick it up, and you ten-ring it for them, and then they're like, oh, well, maybe it's not the gun. But I've seen things like that. I've seen a lot of things like that. You mentioned the further you get away, the more magnified the error becomes. I've seen that with people zeroing rifles at 25 meters and never shooting it at 100 meters and then shooting it over, not a tactical situation, but shooting it over the back of a deer. And because they're maybe not that great a shot, and they had maybe a 2-inch group at 25 yards, they didn't even notice that maybe they were a bit high. And that high becomes a magnified high out into the distance. And you know, they're shooting, you know, 8 inches, 9 inches high at 100 yards because they've never actually put the weapon through its paces at its intended ranges. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Oh, absolutely. And we, along with that, and I mentioned this, I believe, in the first interview I did with you, is one of my mentors and an instructor we have out in Virginia, who goes by the nickname of Doc Gunn, has he applies this to all your equipment, and he calls it the happy family. And each piece of gear has to work with every other piece of gear. And in the last pistol course, some of your listeners were learning that, too, that the holster they bought didn't necessarily work with the gun they brought, or the holster didn't work with the pants they were wearing, or the cover garment they were using, or, you know, you start adding pieces onto your belt or into your ensemble, and we have to make sure that each piece works with every other piece.
Yeah, I just experienced that. I had somebody send me a holster and said, you know, try it out, say you like it. They made it for a 45, a 1911 frame, which is one of my primary carry weapons. And it was designed to be adjustable, so you could set it for as high or low as you wanted on your belt line. Well, the way they had it adjusted, to me, it didn't carry comfortably. It was too high. But I tried it on that way, and it worked fine, and it drew fine. Well, I dropped it down into some lower holes to lower the frame, so it would carry further, you know, below the waistline and lower. And when I tried to draw the weapon, it was locked in there like in a retention holster.
Sure.
It was absolutely impossible to one-hand draw that holster, and you would think that nobody would ever do that, but, you know, I could have been wearing a different belt when I tried it, and it would have been fine, and then wearing a thicker, heavier web belt, maybe the belt was part of why it didn't draw well. I think that that is something you don't really think of until you have it happen, so I think you have to check things not just on this, like, mile-high view, but also every day if you're going to carry, when you put that weapon on, make sure you can draw it that day, because you might be wearing the same thing you wore yesterday.
Sure. And we have also, I guess, let me put it this way, an announcement I make at every class, is, and it's said tongue-in-cheek, but we actually mean it when we say it, is that I genuinely hope that every piece of gear, every gun, every accoutrement that anyone here brought, I hope that it fails. And I want it to happen on the range. I really do. I want guns to break. I want holsters to fall apart. I want flashlights not to work. I want everything to break because I want it to happen there and not when their life depends on it. And we need to get out there and work this stuff through and make sure that the bugs and the hiccups and figuring out which piece that we need to replace or get something different, we want to do it out on the range, not in the middle of our gunfight.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. On gunfights, I guess, or the potential for them, we had kind of talked by email about something else that's going on right now that right now at least is somewhat peaceful but has a propensity to spiral down, or something like it in the future could spiral down into riots. And we talked a lot about the London riots last time you were on. But what do you make of this Occupy Wall Street thing? Not so much the why behind it, but is there a potential for this to turn into something other than what it appears to be right now?
No doubt about it. It appears to be where our country's entering the phase that England, Greece, and a lot of the European countries were in 3 or 4 years ago, with the first peaceful protests, the first, you know, groups of people going out saying we're not happy for whatever reason. And as this goes on, as you see the economic turmoil you know, happening. I can't imagine that that's not going to be the potential of what we're seeing here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm even more pessimistic than you. I look at this, and I've been calling these people useful idiots. I see a larger hand at play here, very leftist agenda, not even trying to make it political, but leftist even from, you know, a U.S. liberal perspective. And I see that I actually think there are some people, not all people involved, but some of the people behind this actually want this to become riotous. That's their goal.
Very well could be. And as far as your audience goes and the people listening, we're, you know, I'm not even choosing a side on it. I'm just saying this is a sign of the times, and make sure that you're ready to stay home for a while.
And, I mean, if you start looking at this thing, it was they're calling it Occupy Wall Street, but now there's people in Washington, there's people in San Francisco. So this is getting coordinated and on a kind of a national level. I think that people look at London and go, well, if you're in England, you're not that far from London. Where in the U.S., if it's in New York City and you're in Texas, whatever. But, but I mean, we're seeing this kind of perk up in all major U.S. cities is what I see. Like, the goal is basically to have one of these groups sitting in every major U.S. city.
Sure. And at what point does it start affecting commerce to the point where UPS can't move or the planes aren't flying or the highways are shut? Who knows? And it may just be a localized thing. But, again, you know, be ready to stay home for a while. Make sure you've got your, you know, medications up to date and, you know, everything you need for a week or two or three or a month. Who knows?
And, I mean, on that note, I mean, do you think that people that live in these cities that maybe think they're not really in the area still have a lot to worry about if this thing kind of escalates?
Sure.
I mean,
everybody needs to eat, and everybody eventually is going to need some sort of trauma care, and everybody's eventually going to need, you know, some sort of, you know, ambulance, police, you know, all that kind of stuff. It all starts getting affected. You know, there's, you know, not to get too Reagan-like here, but there's a trickle-down with all that stuff. It will affect you eventually. And I think most of us, even the preppers in your audience who have managed to get their retreat put together, still have friends and family who live in cities. You know, there's still going to be people in your life you care about who are in the middle of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I've been telling people, if you live in any of these big cities, have your bug out plan in place and be ready to go, and have kind of like a secondary contingency to get other people to come with you, and know what you're going to do with them, even if they're not buying into it right now. Even if they're saying, forget it, there's nothing to worry about, it's just a bunch of college kids down there. I don't think people realize that the people that are even there right now, I don't see as the big threat. I see them being like the tipping point, and once it starts, then the dregs of humanity come out and, you know, start smashing things and go after, you know, London, they were all saying they're going after the rich people, but the rich people were people like you and me, small business owners.
Right. And we have to admit that the people who are protesting right now are the people who could afford to go. It's when you get, you know, the people who are truly, you know, upset and can't afford food or whatever, that, you know, when they get mad, that's when you're going to start seeing, you know, some more angle to this, unless, of course, what you're saying with the agitation starts happening, and who knows, it's all a possibility. All I know is there's a huge amount of unrest in everyone. I've noticed in the past year there's far less, I don't see people arguing in parking lots, I don't see people arguing with the clerk at the store, I don't see that kind of anger anymore. I see a general malaise about people anymore. They just can't plan for the future. And I see that it's just kind of permeating through everyone that I meet. There's a depression and an unhappiness in everyone because they see no future. And they can't put their finger on it, and I can't really put my finger on it other than to say I think it really is economic. I think no one knows how to plan for the future right now. They can't put money away. They can't think about buying a house or a new car or putting their kid through college because everything is so uncertain.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that my concern with this kind of thing blowing up, and one of the more alarming things that I've seen, is I've seen a lot of people online voicing tentative support for what's going on here, and I know the people, and I know their mindset toward liberty, and I'm thinking they're kind of backing someone that's completely the opposite of who they are, and it's because people have this malaise, as you're saying, that anybody that's in opposition to what is perceived as the problem must be somebody to side with, and that's why I'm actually really concerned that this thing grows roots and becomes a movement and then turns out really, really bad.
because it has the propensity just because, well, you know, the evil people on Wall Street, that's something that America is very likely to get behind now without thinking about what that really means. So that puts us all in a position where you get into kind of an us and them mentality, and if you're not us, you're them.
Right, right. And, you know, there's a old saying, I forget, someone wrote a college paper on it, but everything always comes back to Hitler, and it's because people always use that as an example. But, I mean, Hitler was anti-communist, so, you know, if you got on his side, you were against the communists. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing where, well, maybe both sides are wrong.
Yeah, yeah, and I've been saying lately that, you know, that's the whole enemy of your enemy is your friend thing, but sometimes the enemy of your enemy isn't even your enemy's enemy. He's your enemy's friend, and the whole thing is set up to lure you into one side or the other, where you're controllable. So I don't want to go too deep into the politics of this. I want to talk more about practical stuff we can do, but I thought it was interesting to have a, you know, kind of an open discussion between you and I and the way we're seeing this thing, but, I just, from your perspective, you know, from people solidifying themselves, being prepared to get out, being prepared to bug in, what have you, how bad do you think that particular event could become, and how quickly could it really blow up?
Again, I gave up predicting the future 20 years ago. It could happen overnight, and it could take years. You know, 20 years ago, if you asked me if the dollar was still going to be solvent now and we would be, you know, have any type of economy at all, I would have been laughing. So, you know, I've learned to pace myself a little bit more with this stuff as I've grown older, but at this point, economically, I've never seen this tumultuous, and the potential for problems, who knows what's going to light that fire. It's going to happen though.
Comparing it to, like, let's say we talked a lot about Rodney King's riots last time in LA. If you get that kind of event going on in 10 cities at the same time, what does that do to the nation as a whole?
How about something a little even less incredible than that? Gaddafi's regime is, you know, in its death throes right now, and I've heard everything reported from 10,000 to 20,000 surface-to-air missiles have gone missing out of his armories. They found one in Mexico 2 weeks ago. So you tell me, one jet airliner gets shot down out of the air, what's that going to do?
Yeah, yeah.
That's going to shut down the airspace. I mean, that will be it, and, you know, the economy at this point is so fragile, I don't know how much it could take.
So, I mean, what do you think people should be doing personally, like in their homes and their neighborhoods, as far as defense for this and preparation for this? Because, like, I think what you're saying, if I hear you right, is you can't tell me when. You can't tell me for how long. You can't tell me exactly what it's going to be like, but you're telling me something. We're going to deal with something. And
well, that's a guess on my part also. But the people in your audience, and generally your philosophy from what I've been able to gather, is that this is a lifestyle. This is how we live. This isn't like something that we're necessarily prepping for an event that we think is going to happen tomorrow. We're just always prepared.
Correct.
And that's the way I would start with this. You know, much like most of the people I know carry a pistol with them every day. Is it because they're anticipating a gunfight? No. Not at all. It's probably the last thing on their mind, and they put their gun on like they do their watch and tuck their handkerchief into their pocket. It's just another thing they carry because they may need it.
Yeah, there's that one email going around now that says, I don't carry a gun because I feel inadequate. I carry a gun because if I face three armed thugs without a gun, I am inadequate.
Exactly. And if you knew you were going to a gunfight again, you'd take a rifle with. So, you know, we're carrying pistols because it's a last-ditch piece of emergency equipment. And the key word there is emergency. You know, how often are we faced with emergencies? They're not daily. Not at all. And what we're seeing with the world right now, it's cyclical. It's a typical thing that has happened over and over again with every society that has grown to the size of ours or Europe or whatever. You know, it happened to the Romans. It happened to the Greeks. It's happened to every society that has, you know, attempted any type of civil economic model like we have. And it's doomed. I mean, it eventually will be because, you know, we go back to the democracy wheel where at some point people learn how to vote themselves money out of the treasury. And that doesn't matter if you want to declare that welfare is the problem or military spending or banker bailouts or General Motors, whatever it is, you know, or politicians just skimming off the top. Eventually somebody figures out how to take more than what's coming in. And that, you know, it's simple math. Here we are. How long can you sustain that? No idea. But we've reached a point at which we have to be concerned as people who care about ourselves and our families. And that's where I'm at. You're either going to keep looking forward ahead down the road, or you're going to put blinders on and just let it hit you.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned something interesting there, and it's kind of one of the subjects I really wanted to cover with you today was shotguns and rifles for home defense. I talk to a lot of people about, you know, guns. It's a cool topic for me. Like any guy that's into the subject, you know, what do you got? What do you have? Hunting guns, defense weapons, whatever. And I'm always struck by the person that, you know, has the sniper rifle and talks about defense. And I can see some uses for that, but if you're sniping a guy at 1,000 yards, it's probably not a self-defense situation, unless you're in a military unit and it's a coordinated type thing. But I do believe what you said is absolutely true. I carry a handgun when I am away from my home because it's not practical or legal for me to carry an AR or an 870. And if it were practical and legal, then I probably would, because it's a much better tool. So when people say, well, what's your handgun for self-defense in the home? It's not. It's a shotgun or a carbine. And just kind of your thoughts on that and what makes a good home defense tool.
In your case, that's probably right. In my case, if it were legal to carry a rifle, I probably still wouldn't be carrying a rifle because I need both my hands to do most of my work.
Well, no, hold on. There's two things that are legal and practical.
Practical is the word. But I do keep a rifle in my vehicle. You know, when I travel and I'm in states where I can, that's what I do. Since 9/11, I've really never traveled anywhere without a rifle. I feel that's very important, and I don't think you have to see too many Mumbai-style hotel attacks until you go, yeah, maybe I should be a little more heavily armed. For home defense, truth be told, I've gone in a circle with that. There are times when I keep a pistol, there are times when I keep an 870 or a Mossberg 500 there, and there's other times when I've kept a AR-15 sitting in the corner. It's going to depend on a lot of factors. For your listeners, the first thing is, where do you live? Are you in an apartment? Are you in a house? Do you have brick walls in your house? Do you have drywall? Do you have bystanders in the house? Are there children in other rooms? Is this a gun that you have to operate as well as your wife and as well as your children? Masad Ayoub calls it a pool gun. I think that's a good term, where we have a single gun that's used for home defense that every member of the family is trained on. In that case, maybe the shotgun isn't the best choice. When you have smaller statured females and children in the house, shotguns are heavy. They take two hands to operate. They may not be the best choice. The positives of the shotgun are they're extremely powerful. Without special permit from the feds, it's probably the most lethal weapon we can own, is a 12-gauge shotgun firing buckshot or deer slugs. It's intimidating. Most police officers that I've talked to, the old guard who used to carry the shotguns in the car, will tell you, I pointed a lot of pistols at people and I didn't get much response. When I pointed a shotgun at them, they usually complied. You know,
yeah.
It does have an intimidation factor to it, and the pose that you take holding a shotgun, which is hard to do over the radio here, but there's nothing else that people do that is that pose. You know, holding a pistol in your hand, you could be holding your cell phone, you could be holding a radio, nobody really knows, especially in a low light condition, but the silhouette of somebody holding a shotgun, they're holding a shotgun.
Correct.
It's pretty obvious. And
you know, you talk about the lethality there, Frank. I remember stories of World War One when they started using the trench gun.
The trench gun, yeah.
Right, and our soldiers that had them, if their trench was overrun and they knew they were going to be captured and taken prisoner, they threw their freaking shotgun away and like grabbed a rifle from a dead guy so that when they were taken prisoner and held up a rifle over their head, they weren't holding a shotgun, because if you were caught with a shotgun, the carnage was so hostile that you were probably shot before you were taken prisoner. Because that's how hated the shotgun was in trench warfare. So there's a reason behind that lethality.
It is. It's an ounce of lead either way that you're dumping into somebody. And with buckshot, you're talking about 9 pellets, you know, in double-aught buck, and you're causing 9 temporary and permanent wound channels all next to each other. In the torso, generally, that's not survivable. People have survived it, but it's generally not survivable. With pistol bullets, totally different issue. You know, if you shot somebody 9 times in that same area, yes, we might get the same effect, but we usually don't get that opportunity. As far as the bad sides of the shotgun. Again, it's heavy. It requires both hands to operate, and you're limited on ammunition. You know, you're talking probably, some places you're limited to 5 shots, some places 3 if you're going to, convert your hunting shotgun to use in the bedroom and it's off time. Maybe you get 7, 9 in some shotguns. And
what are your thoughts
that ammo goes fast.
On the weight and size issue and dropping from a 12 to a 20? A 20-gauge 870 frame is a lot lighter.
20 is okay, but we have a problem with the buckshot then. I'm trying to remember.
Go ahead. Number 4 buck is damn lethal in a 20-gauge.
It is, and let me prefix this by saying, anytime I talk about calibers or ammunition, I want to say first to everyone listening, I don't want to be shot with any of it, including a BB gun. But we do have enough documentation now with police departments that we're trying to use number 4 buck that it's not the fight stop or double out is. It's okay. It's going to be better than shooting somebody with a pistol, but it's not. Your enemy doesn't explode into a shower of sparks with this stuff.
Sure.
And with the 20-gauge, I think number 2 is about the most common buckshot that we can get for it because the larger pellets won't fit squarely into the 12-gauge shell.
Correct.
We have a problem trying to pack it in there. You're starting to reduce your ammunition lethality at that point, and everything's a trade-off. We've got to figure out what's going to work in our lives. Now,
you can have 9.33 caliber, double-aught slugs from a 12-gauge. You do get about 27, 24 caliber projectiles out of a 20-gauge 3-inch magnum. And
right.
To me, that's why I've always seen it, especially at home defense ranges, as adequate.
Right. Number 4, buck in a 12-gauge, I think, is like 27 pellets or something like that. The 20-gauge itself, I have a Mossberg 20-gauge that I have set up with a youth model stock on it, and it's for females to, start learning how to shoot 12 or shotguns. I personally find it the most uncomfortable gun I've ever shot in my life. It pounds me. And it's lightweight because the Mossbergs have the aluminum receivers on them and all that, and all the recoil just goes right into your shoulder. It is not an easier gun to shoot by any means. And that's something your listeners, if you think you're going to get a 20 gauge because it has less recoil, well, shoot the thing first. Do some comparison shooting and figure out if it's really for you or not.
I think a lot of that is the stock length, though, because it screws up the
geometry of the
length of pull and the way that the form is taken. And if you take that gun and put a full-length stock on it, it's not as short anymore, but I think it would be a lot more comfortable to shoot.
Right, but they can't hold it up anymore.
They can't hold it up.
Again, everything's this trade-off. And with most of our smaller statured shooters, we've got to cut that stock off. We almost need to take 4 inches off most shotgun stocks for most females to be able to operate them comfortably.
Wow.
At least, run the slide and have a length of pull they can use.
Yeah.
As far as carbines go, I think we talked about this in a past interview. The 5.56 round is actually a pretty good home defense round as far as non-penetration through walls. We see a lot of SWAT teams going to it instead of 9mm now. 9mm, even hollow points, when it was hitting drywall, the hollow point was just filling up with drywall dust, and it was acting just like a ball round, and it was going through multiple rooms. And the 223 5.56 round ends up, breaking up or stopping. We see it as far less of a penetration problem indoors.
Yeah, Boston.
I know that's surprising because it's a rifle.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, I was very skeptical about that when I first started doing the show. I actually advised people against the 5.56 for home defense because of the fear of that. But I looked at a lot of the stuff that Box of Truth has done with it, and when you just take it out and you shoot it at drywall and you compare the results, it's very clear that there's actually less of an over-penetration problem because that round is so high velocity and it upsets and just it fragments so easily that it's just you get a better result out of it.
Right, and we also find that it does terrible on car doors. I see very few of them go through car doors. But then again, I see very few pistol rounds that will go through car doors either. Home defense stuff, it's gonna be a case-by-case basis. It's going to be, what the person can handle, what they can deal with. When we get into long guns, whether it's shotguns or rifles, we're talking about lighting issues now. You know, how are we going to light up our target? You know, if this happens at 2 a.m. or in the middle of the night, are we actually going to turn our lights on and ruin our night vision and go out into the unknown and look for this thing? Or are we going to camp out and wait for them? Do we have to rescue our children? At some point, we're probably going to need a flashlight. So when we start mounting lights on weapons, I'm a fan of having a light on my long guns. But I also have to caution everybody, you start using your gun as a flashlight. And, you know, that creates some serious muzzle problems when you have other family members in the house. You know, is that you, Junior, and you're pointing your gun at them? So you have to think about that too.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and it's you know, a mixed bag. If you go to a long gun, you can't, you know, have the flashlight in the other hand because you need two hands to run the weapon. So there's always that. What I've personally noticed, though, in most stories that are successful home defense stories where somebody broke in and the bad guy got shot and the homeowner didn't get hurt, are the homeowners, and, you know, a lot of times they're older ladies and things like that, they take up a defensive position and they wait. They don't go through their house, and that gives them a tactical advantage. I remember one, you know, I just felt so bad for the guy because he was shot through the stomach and into the spine with a .357, and he survived, but he ended up in a wheelchair for the rest of his life because he broke into the wrong 68-year-old lady's house.
That's for him?
I'm being sarcastic, Frank. Yeah. she hit him twice with a .357 in the guts, and one severed his spinal cord, or didn't sever it, but damaged it to where he couldn't walk. If it severed, he probably would have died. But he was in this wheelchair in this documentary going, that old lady just wanted to kill somebody. And I'm thinking, you probably shouldn't have broken her house, but it also made me realize that is probably, the best case scenario. But I think there's also times when you have to go looking because it's easy to say, I'll wait it out. But what if you're on one side of the house, your kids are in another side of the house?
Right. That's the eternal question. I have no answer for this other than run to them as fast as you can. The idea of clearing your house by yourself, you know, working the corners and doing all that sort of thing, first of all, doing it yourself is an effort in futility because you can't watch your back. Two people doing it correctly, hours and hours to clear everything correctly to make sure you're not leaving any space unchecked as you pass through it. We don't have that kind of time when our kids are in the house. It's not a good situation. I have some, we have a small class that we teach on that for home defense, and we have a number of tricks and things which I don't want to say out over the air in case any of the bad guys are listening, but we give families things to work with on that. There are some answers. They're not good answers, but they're answers.
Yeah, one of the things I'm a big fan of is dogs. For that very reason, and not necessarily the Rin-Tin-Tin attack dog, but you could have a person take up a spot in your home, and like you're saying, to clear the house could take hours before you would know, but I don't see many people pulling that over on a dog. If there's a stranger in a house, they've got the nose and they got the ears, and they're going to know it, and
sure.
Most dogs, when there's a stranger in the house, no matter how nice a dog they are, they get really, really freaking upset. So I've always considered our dogs, while, you know, even I have a huge German Shepherd, but he's not a trained attack dog anyway, but I've always considered them an integrated portion of our security in our home.
Absolutely. And it's an alarm system. You know, that's what it is. It's another layer of defense. They're great. I'm a big fan of dogs. I think anybody who can have a dog in the house, that's a good thing to have. It's going to bark and it's going to alert you to problems.
We have a sign up out on the edge of our property, and we have a gate that blocks the road, and it's a silhouette of a German Shepherd. And it says, I can make it to the gate in 2.3 seconds. Can you?
Right. Yeah. And it's true.
So, I mean, that's kind of one of the things I've always thought. And I even think the little yippy-yappy Pomeranians or whatever, as long as they let you know something's going on. I think there's also a case in here where we start to have to look at, like, you know, threat levels. There's kind of the everyday threat level, there's always a threat out there. But like with some of these riots and stuff like that, I think people maybe need to have almost like a DEFCON system when there is civil unrest going on about, you know, maybe certain things that day-to-day are okay. As threat levels increase, they maybe need to have some procedures that they have plans for. Or the minute we think somebody's breached our security, there's a procedure.
Yeah, and the entire family has to be on the same page with that. Again, we come to a lot of wishful thinking with this kind of stuff. Most of the stories I read, I mean, every once in a while we get the story of the little old lady who shoots somebody in the dark. But generally these attacks, when they happen in the home, happen during broad daylight or during the day. And, one of the best ones is the idea of a safe room. We're gonna have a safe room in our house and that's where we're all gonna go when this happens. When this happens at 2 p.m. and your wife's in the kitchen and you're out in the garage and the kids are in the backyard, how exactly are we gonna get to that safe room and how are we going to get alerted to this?
Why don't we just ask the guy, hold on, you can do what you want while we go to our safe room, right?
Right, exactly.
Sorry, Mr. Bad Guy. As soon as we get our safe room, you can do whatever you need to do.
You know, the first layer of this, I'm going to say, whatever defensive tool you've chosen to use, you need to have it ready to deploy at all times. So if you're going to rely on OC spray, pepper spray, then carry it on your person. If you're going to rely on a pistol, then have it on your person. During your waking hours, you should be armed and ready on your property. That's my first advice.
Thanks for that, because I've had people tell me when I've said on the air that I carry at home. I carry, when I go home, I don't take my gun off. When I'm sitting around the house in the evening watching, you know, Big Bang Theory, my gun's on me. And people say, you know, isn't that a little bit overkill? And I'm like, well, I don't really think so, because I don't know that I'm going to have time to run in and grab the shotgun from out from, you know, under the bed or what have you, if somebody decides to come through the door.
We've had two students over the past 10 years that I know of who have used their guns in their home to defend themselves during daylight hours, and they wouldn't have been able to do it if they weren't wearing their gun.
I'm not paranoid.
No, not at all. It's, you know, no different than, again, wearing your watch or having a pen. You know, you may need to write. You may need to know what time it is. You may need to shoot someone. It's that simple. In this case, we had two roommates who were students. This was about, I want to say, 8-10 years ago in Michigan before they had a carry permit up there. And they were advised, carry your guns, you know, wherever you can legally. So one of them took to carrying her gun in their home. And they were sitting on their back deck on a July afternoon, sunny, 80 degrees out. They had a 3-year-old Rottweiler, as I'm remembering the story, that for some reason just decided to attack the roommate. Got his teeth in on her leg. When later at the hospital, they said that tooth was within a millimeter of hitting her artery. The other roommate jumped up, drew her gun, and shot the dog, saved her roommate's life. You know, very bizarre happening. I was never really filled in on totally on how that occurred, but, you know, here we have an example of, had she not been wearing her gun, the dog would have got its teeth in there and worked harder, and that would have been it. The second, we have a student who was sitting on his couch I think his day off during the week, and he was watching TV just sitting on his couch, and there had been a robbery in the neighborhood. The robbers careened into his front yard in a stolen car, ran up his front steps and kicked his front door in as they're running from the cops, and he drew his gun and shot the first one as he came through the door. Other than that, he would have been a hostage.
Sure.
Or dead.
Sure.
Second one ran off and it caught him down the block. But, you know, those are the two stories I know of students that we've had over the years that have used their guns while wearing them at home.
I think sometimes people like overestimate the likelihood that somebody that's out to steal from you isn't out to kill you as well. A personal story here, my grandfather, when he was he was probably close to 70 years old, he was working for my father at his gas station, and a guy held him up, and fortunately he held him up with a 25 automatic. And the old man was a 25-year military veteran, and he just wasn't going to be robbed. And so he kicks the guy, and was unable to disarm him, but he kicks him and he runs out of the office at the station and goes to run around the back of the thing, and he falls. This guy runs up to him, points the gun at his head, pulls the trigger, and it misfires. You would think at that point, okay, the guy would haul ass. No, he works the action and tries to do it again, and the old man managed to get his arm up. He was shot in the back of the arm. And if he'd been shot with a .38, it probably would have penetrated and went into his head, but since it was a .25, it hit the bone, and he ended up actually, you know, years later when he died, he was buried with that slug still in him that decided it wasn't worth removing. Mm-hmm. And I just think that level of violence, I don't think that most people are really in touch with the fact that, you know, here's just a guy that was going to rob an old man for some money. But as soon as his quest to do that failed, it became to kill him. That was his goal. It wasn't to get the money anymore. It was to kill the guy.
Well, I've said it to you before, I don't make my defensive decisions on suspect intent. I make it on suspect capabilities. And he's walked up to me and pointed a gun at me and said, do this or I will. He's already intended, or he's already spoken to me that he's willing to kill me. That's all I need to know.
And that's kind of where I wanted to lead you in this. I think that people need to psychologically deal with the point that at some point they might have to make the decision of when to and when not to pull the trigger.
And again, I can't predict how anyone's next fight's going to be. It's definitely something that people should sit down and have some introspective thought about. You need to know if you can do it, and you need to know if you're going to be willing to do it. If you're coming at it from a Hollywood aspect or an internet commando aspect, you know, you're kidding yourself. If you've really sat down and thought about it and figured out what's important and what's not and what the consequences of it are and if you can live with it or you can't live with it, I'm the first one to say guns aren't for everybody, and I'm the first one to say that not everyone is capable of doing this, but most of us actually are. If we sit down and we're honest about it, we can condition ourselves to be able to do this when the time comes.
I saw a great article years ago by a guy you've mentioned today, and you've mentioned him several times, Masad Ayoub, that talked about having in place an after-shooting plan. Basically, that just because somebody broke in your house and you did what you know we would all look at and go was a good defensive shoot doesn't necessarily mean that responding law enforcement is going to see it that way. And I can't remember where I read the article. I don't know if it was in Backwoods Home or on his blog, but it was things like, you know, which, so when, you know, mom's trying to get dad out of the clink, who to call. I mean, what are your thoughts on something like that? Is that something you advise
me to do? I couldn't agree with him more, and I couldn't give him enough accolades for putting all that together, and I make nothing from this, but Mass is someone I consider a mentor, and I have, he presents a class for those in the Chicagoland area that's in, I believe, Aurora, Illinois, usually over the winter, January, March, that area. It's a two-day legal course where you sit in a hotel meeting room, and for 12 hours a day, he explains to you how to navigate the legal system. The best $400 I ever spent on anything gun-related, and I've taken it three times. I would highly recommend that for everybody. If you can sit down with Ayoub and get run through that class, you will look at the world different.
And what I really thought was awesome about the way he was putting this together wasn't it wasn't just for your knowledge. It was documenting it. So when you're sitting in the clink, because you're in the wrong county when you do this or whatever, because, I mean, to me, somebody breaks in your house, and I'm the responding law enforcement officer, broke in your house, you shot him, let us clean this up for you, sir. Thank you for helping us out. But that's not the reality.
No, the reality is the state looks at it as a citizen's been murdered. You know, it doesn't matter if that citizen broke into anybody's house. You know, the police, when they get there, their job isn't to be judge and jury. Their job is to take a report and to treat it as a murder scene. And what Mass will tell you is that if you are prosecuted for this, it's what's called an affirmative defense. Most of the time when the state comes after you for whatever, it's the burden of proof is on the state. The prosecutor has to prove you did whatever. Well, in this case, you're already admitting you did it. Yeah, I shot him, but it was for this reason. So it's an affirmative defense. You have to prove that what you did was justified.
Versus them proving you did it because you called the police and said, hey, he's dead, come get him.
Well, you're going to admit you shot him.
Sure.
I mean, you know, it's not like you're going to stand there and say, no, I didn't do that. Yeah, I did it. I defended myself. So it's an affirmative defense, and that puts the burden of proof on you, and it's a totally different legal situation. You know, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not here to give everybody that advice, but it's something you want to check into and understand what you're getting into.
I've been trying to get Moss on the show, and if I do, I think that might be the first.
Oh, he's a much better interview than I am.
I don't know about that, man.
he's great. Yeah, I've learned so much from him over the years, and I plan on learning more, and I consider him a friend and a mentor, and he's wonderful.
Well, as we're wrapping up here, we did talk quite a bit about civil unrest and the potential for it, and I think you and I both feel that it's likely, even if we don't say it's not if but when, we both feel it's a likely event to eventually occur. What are some advice you can give to people? I just had Carl Denninger on, and when I asked him what people should do to prepare for this, he basically said change the system.
And he didn't have a real good answer, and I don't expect him to because he's an economist and a commodities trader. Very switched on in that world, but as a prepper, you know, I mean, that's just not his world. You, on the other hand, are all about making sure that we provide the best defense we can for ourselves. So, you know, asking you, in your own neighborhood, what are some things you can do? Because I don't think that if this stuff really blows up, people can plan to stand by themselves.
Well, without getting into the food prep and medical and all that sort of stuff, the first thing I would say is get a rifle and get trained on it. That's it. The rifle itself, whether we have civil unrest or not, I believe it was Jeff Cooper who said, you know, the rifle is what makes you a citizen. And when you pick one up, that's how you feel. You're no longer a slave. You're not an underling. You're not, you know, an unfree person. So the rifle is really what maintains liberty in this country, and the fact that we have an armed populace and people who are trained with rifles, that to me is probably one of the number one things every able-bodied person should do. So on that line, if you don't have a rifle yet, get it and learn how to use it.
Okay, and actually you're going to talk a little bit about, you have a class on that, don't you?
Oh, yeah, it doesn't sound like I'm trying to plug myself now. Okay.
he's not trying to plug himself, folks.
Yeah.
Set him up.
Yeah, well, and how ironic. At the end of October here, on the 29th and 30th, which is Halloween weekend, I think Halloween's on the Monday, in Rochester, Indiana, we're going to be doing our Level 1 rifle course. So if you've never shot your rifle or you don't have any skill with it, that's fine. Come on out anyway. But we're going to give two spots away for that to your listeners. So the first people who call me after this show will get their spots. The way we did this last time is I had the people who called send me a $75 deposit, which they got back at the class when they showed up. So that was going to hold their spot for them.
Sure, because you're holding a C.
Right. And it's a two-day course. We're going to do a night shoot. It's all described on our website and that sort of thing. If anybody has any questions, feel free to go ahead and email me or whatever. But it's info@fortressdefense.com would be our email address, and our phone number is 708-522-8060.
And to win, people got to call you, right? Don't go emailing Frank going, did I win? You got to call them if you want.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be gone by the time I get to the emails.
Sure.
So, you know, call me and get it. Like I said, I think it was a minute after the people had listened to the show that they were gone the last time, so... But we'd love to have your listeners out, and great people, and, you know, it'll be rifles, so we're going to learn transition to handgun also, so you'll have to bring a handgun with. But we can give you all those details when we talk to you.
Well, real quick, I mean, on your rifle course, what type of rifle does a person get? ARs?
I prefer any type of semi-automatic, what we call a battle rifle, meaning it's designed for military purposes. It's a military-type rifle, which means it's going to be able to get hot. That's the biggest issue. When we have guns like lever-action rifles come into our classes, they can't stand the heat. After about 20 shots of rapid fire, they're going to seize up. You know, when they cool off, they run again, but it's just not practical for real serious purposes. So your AR-15, your Mini 14, the SIG 5.56, FALs, 30 carbines, even M1 Garands, anything that's designed for heat and high volumes of fire.
Okay. And you mentioned transitioning to handgun, so I guess that's whatever the person carries. I mean, that's
revolver, pistol. We don't, you know, it's fine. You bring it, we'll train you on it. I've had classes over the years where we go into an area and we have people who want to learn how to do this with their 22 rifles or their bolt action rifles, and we'll set up a class for people and do that. This particular class, though, we prefer something magazine fed, semi-automatic.
Okay, so leave your SKs at home, folks.
The SKS is fine. That's actually okay. If you want to load from stripper clips, that's cool, too. Because that gun's designed to get hot.
It is.
And it will function, yeah.
Yeah, I've had the surplus models where you run them at the range until, you know, all that cosmoline they were soaked in is just pouring out onto your hand. They keep running.
And it's hot, too.
Yeah. Yeah, smoke off of the barrel, and yeah.
Sure.
It's a good gun. It's heavy,
and
it's a
AKs good gun. Are fine. You know, for people with the budgets, you can start getting into the Styrogs and that sort of thing, but those, they cost too much for me. But as long as it's designed for some sort of military purpose and to get hot, we're usually good on that. So,
I cool, folks. So, Frank, you want to give that number out one more time here as we wrap up today?
708-522-8060.
Okay.
8060.
All right, folks, and I'll tell you this. This is airing Friday, the 7th. So if you are listening to this on Saturday, the 8th, or later, don't even bother unless you just want to attend the course, which I'm sure you'd be happy to have.
Especially and the regular cost for it is $250, so everybody knows.
Okay, cool. So two people get to go for free, and give it a shot, guys. Hey, Frank, thanks for joining us again. As always, you are a stark dose of reality with no Hollywood fluff.
Oh, thanks, Jack. Appreciate it.
And I mean that in the most positive way. I just realized that could have sounded a little bit off. You're a great interview. I just mean that you don't bring any of the
I'm not the Lindsay Lohan of the gun community.
You're not blinging out with the Glocks, man. As always, you are a great friend of the community, a great sponsor, and we always gain a lot of wisdom from you when you're on the show.
Appreciate it, Jack.
All right, folks, with that, today this has been Jack Spirico along with Frank Sharp Jr., helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to T-Spaz, that's T-S-P-A-Z, T-Spaz.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episodes.